My name is Peter Thompson. I'm from Minneapolis, and I'm a retired lawyer. I've been teaching last week and this week around the issues of last week. We did quite a bit with the war on terrorism and a particular case I've been working on that involves the issue of torture. And we're just going to touch on the end of that. My last session on Friday, we're going to go back to that issue. And this week we've been looking at, last Friday we looked at just war and nonviolence as two different ways to approach resolving conflicts. And then last night we talked about how President Obama handled the Nobel Peace Prize. And we looked at his speech, and we had some commentators that came in and did some commentary on that speech and the irony of that situation of him deploying 30,000 soldiers at the time he was receiving the Nobel Peace Prize. So for any of you who were there last night in particular, I just want to go through how I generally run sessions. I tried cases for 33 years, so I'm very used to having to dodge bullets and people shoot stuff at me. So don't wait until I pause, you know, to, if you have any question, any anecdote that comes to mind, any, you know, penetrating statement you want to make while we're doing the session, don't wait till the end. Just do it, because by the time we get to the end, we're invariably out of time. So just, you know, raise your hand or shoot me a question or throw something at me or whatever. Because lots of times what I've found is that I learn an awful lot. I mean, we've got a lot of cumulative wisdom here in this room, probably, you know, like 30 people. And I know the reason I teach and come up here and do this is because, you know, I learn a lot from people. And a couple more things about that. Last night, and this always happens, when we got done, several people came up and were asking me some questions. We had this wonderful discussion. And one of them said that, you know, she wasn't smart enough to be able to answer the question during the session. And the other one said he didn't know enough about the underlying facts about the Afghanistan war to ask, you know, to say these things in the whole group. And then we proceeded to talk, and that was baloney. They knew plenty. They were both, you know, some of God's special children. And wherever we're coming from here in this village in particular, just, you know, say it. I have to tell you one other thing. It's just the blessing of Holden. I didn't share this. After the first week, this one guy came to all five sessions, and this is what I mean about, you know, sharing and being in relationship with each other. And at the start of the week, he was really heavy and kind of dark, you know, it was hard for him. And he'd come up after a lot of sessions and talk. And after the last session, he said, "Will you come down to the bus?" And I said, "Sure, I'll be down at the bus." I was down at the bus, and he came up to me, and he said, "You know, before this week, my life was heading this way. And now my life's going to head this way when I get out." And his face had changed. I mean, he was light. He had a big smile on his face. It's just wonderful. I mean, just for that alone. So let's dialogue as much as you'd like. I don't know where you can get more chairs other than there's four right in this most uncomfortable spot. And if you want to go further back, yeah, why don't we, just for the late arrivers, that'd be a great idea. So, you know what, oops, I'm afraid we bumped something. So I was just, you know, in terms of this whole thing, you know, dialogue, which is the most wonderful thing we can do here. We can have conversations during the time. We can have conversations up in the dining hall after the time. This is some of the best things that happen in Holden. And dialogue's not the opposite of monologue. It's not even like related exactly to monologue, because dialogue is made up of two root words, duo, that is through, and logos, which is the word or the truth. And so if I am dialoguing with this person, really to truly dialogue, I'm not listening to what she said to try and get a better argument to beat her next time around. I'm actually putting myself in her shoes so I can really understand what her truth is. And that's why these two people, last session, both of whom were friends of mine, you know, they weren't thinking that that's what, you know, dialogue really is. Okay, before we get to civil disobedience, we just have a little more to do on some of the roots of nonviolence. And one of the things last night, and some of you were here, I was saying is that someone was saying, you know, there really wasn't anything else for Obama to do other than to deploy the 30,000 troops. And I said, you know, what other things are there? The great thing about nonviolence, and we'll look at some of the, you know, King and Gandhi and some of those people tonight, is that it is so flexible and it is so creative that really there isn't a set list of 14 things that you can do in response. You can just start from what nonviolence is about is it's neither fight nor flight. It's some third way. And so whatever that third way is that what creative people can do. I'll give you one little, for instance, and then I'll go through kind of a list of a few recent examples of the effectiveness of nonviolence. And so if any of you have been thinking about that question yesterday and, you know, have an idea about what else could we do, what else could Obama have done rather than send 30,000 troops, you know, mention it. The first thing that comes to mind for me is not send 30,000 troops. You know, it's kind of like, you know, non-flight or non-fight. And then, okay, what's the other part? Well, there's probably another part, but we can come up with some of that. For instance, I'll go through a list of a few things, historical things, and we did some of them, and we did some of the things about Jesus a couple of sessions ago, so we're not going to go back there. We're going to take from Jesus forward. But there's this one initiative that started at The Hague, and a friend of mine and a guy from California met there, and they both had the exact same idea, and they'd had the idea for about 10 years. My friend's name is Mel Duncan. It's called the Nonviolent Peace Force. And what they decided to do is try and create a worldwide available peace army, soldiers without guns. And really look at nonviolence and various situations from a very organized and scholarly standpoint. Do the studies, learn how to train, pay the people. And so as we sit here, probably only one or two of you have heard of it, it's becoming a reality. What they want to do finally is have 2,000 trained people ready to go to various conflicts. They have people now in the conflict in Sri Lanka. They're studying to send a group to Darfur. They've been to Uganda. They have a group that has been to Guatemala. And the other big initiative right now is in Mindanao, in the Philippines, where there's a lot of violence. And they have criteria for going, and they have volunteers come in. But the only thing this group is lacking is enough money to really be able to get bigger. I helped them get consultative status in the UN. So now these ideas are being actively put forth in the UN. And it's different than peacekeepers, because the peacekeepers have guns. These people have no weapons. And before they go, they are trained for 3 months in the culture, in the conflict, in the groups that are involved, and they never take sides. What they do is try and show up and end the killing for enough time so that the ideas that the people have can rise organically to the surface and work on finding resolutions. Because the people know better than anyone. So they don't ever come in and say, here's what you have to do. What they do is they live with the people, they get the trust of the people, they show up at their meetings, they do, they go with them if some of the people are threatened. They will do, like if we were having a meeting here, some peace meeting or some human rights meeting or something, they would be standing outside to make sure it didn't get disrupted. And in some really dire situations, and they want to minimize this, they will do something called intervention. That is, go in between. One of the most amazing things, and I won't tell you any other stories, just this one, is in Sri Lanka, there's a big child soldier problem. The Tamil Tigers have kidnapped a lot of the kids and armed them and put them into the conflict. You know, 10, 12-year-old kids. And so what the nonviolent peacemakers have done is gone with, first of all, found out where the kids are, then gone with one of the parents and gone into the camps of the Tamil Tigers and asked for the child back. And in every instance, when they did all the groundwork, they got the kids back. And if a mom had walked into that camp, they probably never would have seen them again. They did it with the kind of confidence that comes out of, you know, a deep faith for whoever they are, human secularists or Christians or Muslims, and these people are from all over the world. And every time they have a new deployment of like 30 people, they will have 20 applications for each position. And they have psychologists from Kenya, and they have grandmas from Wisconsin, and all sorts of stuff. So that's what I mean. The ideas to handle any situation are really right here in this room.
Were those ideas available to Obama?
Oh, yes.
When he made his decision?
Oh, yes. I mean, he has every asset available to him to make a decision, I'm sure. Okay. It's probably a matter of not considering. I mean, Obama mentioned, did you hear last night? Obama mentioned in his speech King and Gandhi and things like that, but he made some statements that were really like fatalistic and despairing. He said, you know, there is some truth in what King and Gandhi say, but this is the real world, and, you know, sometimes we have to make these hard choices.
But I was really impressed in his speech. He even goes on to spell out three nonviolent ways to go about doing things, but then doesn't really rely on those. He says, well, we can use diplomatic efforts and sanctions, we should, and then he goes on to even talk about economic justice. And
right. And then he doesn't do it. Why do you suppose?
I'm not sure.
Yeah. But are those things not going on, and do we just not hear about it? So what does our media tell us? Mm-hmm. I mean, American media versus other media can be very different.
Yeah, well, if he had, and I think the man is a wonderful human being, if he had all these ideas at hand, why not try one of them? I mean, for 200 years, our country has been, you know, using war and bombing and killing as the means to, you know, pursue foreign policy and settle disputes. And he obviously, he even mentioned them in the speech, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, he lays it out, 1, 2, 3.
I think other places in the speech gives us a clue to why he didn't use them. I think it's because of his job. What does the commander-in-chief take as his charge when he takes the job? Exactly. And so that's his first priority. And so in order for him not to do that, he would have to be very confident that, you know, the citizenry word back some of these other ways. Because to
what
take
he's been
a risk.
Getting from the GOP all the way along, as far as anything he proposes, gets shot down.
Really,
so why would this be any different?
Yeah. So it's really up to us, I think. You know, in terms of grassroots movements, in terms of everything people do, a lot of people in this room do wonderful things, you know, to build that. So the paradigm under which the president can think is not just like I was living here when 9/11 happened. And the first thing that everyone was waiting for in terms of response was, when are we going to bomb? And people didn't even have any idea where we should bomb. And we didn't have any idea where we should bomb, you know? So, you know, just to not have bombed and then begin to think about different ways would have been a huge step forward. But the whole idea is that's how we think. That's where we come from. Okay. Just let me list a couple of recent, I have, you know, many, many of these, but I'll just list a couple. You know, Czechoslovakia, in 1989, Czechoslovakia's Velvet Revolution was based on the poetry of Václav Havel. In 1989, Tiananmen Square, what first happened when the soldiers were called out to put down that revolt is they were soldiers from that area around Beijing, and they were overwhelmed with gifts and other goodwill from the people, and they wouldn't hurt the people. A very little known story. What they had to do then is the party had to call on soldiers from North China to come down and do the damage. In 1989, you know, the ANC in South Africa was basically deciding to make a deal and to quit doing any violence in order to be involved in the political process. And here's so 1990, it was the beginning of Buddhist healing movements in Cambodia. They've been going on for 3 decades. Over the killing fields, and they're happening still today. 1991, the dictator of Madagascar was overthrown nonviolently. In 1999, Suharto's authoritarian regime in Indonesia was brought down. In 2000, this nonviolent peace force deployed its first soldiers to Sri Lanka. In 2007, the Pakistani lawyers protested the removal of the Supreme Court justice, and it led to Musharraf's being removed from office. In 2008, and a lot of times we don't think about these things, here's the way I think about this. You remember the surge in Iraq? And then afterwards everyone says, well, the violence is tamped down. You know, when the 60,000 more soldiers got there, violence didn't get tamped down. People started, we were losing more soldiers than we'd ever had. But then Petraeus did a brilliant thing. He paid all the Sunni insurgents $300 a month to quit fighting. That's what tamped down the violence. I mean, that's a weird example of nonviolence because it's already in the midst of war and everything, but the creative uses of, I mean, can you imagine how much we saved in dollars by doing that, you know, rather than having, you know, 150,000 soldiers there for a longer period of time? And in 2010, the marches in Iran. Now, what hasn't happened in Iran is very significant too. We haven't bombed. You know, because there was a lot of rumblings that's, you know, the big joke was during the middle of Iraq, Bush has now got the exit strategy figured out for Iraq. It's through Iran. And, you know, that hasn't happened. And there is a tremendous opposition movement building there. And there was violence, but most of the violence was from the authoritarian regime, the Islamic regime, against the people. But it seemed that is happening. Sometimes these things will take a long time. But it seems like more than 50% of the people voted for that opposition candidate. So, it's my idea that for 200 years, we've gone from war to war to war to war. That's how they teach American history. you know. That's everything, Revolutionary War, Civil War, you know, Spanish-American War, Mexican War, Philippine War, World War I, World War II. But that's how we teach history, is that that hasn't worked. We're not achieving peace. What we need to do is stop relying on domination and start relying on relationship. So why not seriously give this a try in terms of education, training, policies, etc.? Okay, so one of the techniques, the many techniques, so there can be marches, withdrawal of consent to be governed, civil disobedience, prayer, patience, negotiation, mediation, silent vigil, strikes, boycotts, fasting, slowdowns, accompaniment, intervention, observation, concerted political, religious, or social action. Just the world of possibilities that Obama could have considered on that occasion, and that we could consider every day in our lives and corporately as a country. So one of those things that embraces a combination, perhaps, of some of those elements is civil disobedience. Anyone here been civilly disobedient? Okay, well, when we get to anything that sounds like what you would like to tell us about, if you feel comfortable doing that, please tell us. And we've already spent some time on Jesus. Dan Erlander led us, and some other people went through to kind of deconstruct and reconstruct the some of the teachings of Jesus, particularly turning the other cheek, and if they take your cloak, give them your cloak also, and carrying the extra mile. So it really gives a basis for all of us as Christians for nonviolence. So civil disobedience, first of all, just what do you think of when you think of civil disobedience? Do you think that that is unfortunate that it happens, or it's a good thing, or what's the policy? Yeah.
Well, not the policy, but what I notice is that it catches some media attention, so it does bring attention that wouldn't otherwise go to there.
Right. And who usually catches the media attention?
The protesters, usually
the police.
Where the trouble is.
Exactly. I was at the RNC along with Ricky and, I don't know, were some of our kids in town? We were there anyhow with 10,000 people, and the next day in the newspaper, the only news was, you know, a couple of the kids who'd thrown rocks through windows or burned the American flag and got arrested and this and that. The 99% of the people who were there were conducting themselves in a perfectly nonviolent fashion. Now, there are some, and we're going to spend some time on looking a few today, but in particular tomorrow, I'm going to go through story of a famous client of mine, Father Roy Bourgeois, and his civil disobedience. Some people, like Roy Bourgeois, see an injustice that is so great and it so offends them that they can't not do something about it that's going to get them in trouble. He calls it divine obedience rather than civil disobedience. And so the policy here behind civil disobedience is much like the First Amendment, being able to express yourself, share your views, raise issues that are important. And so here is one statement about the policy. Everyone can read that? The traditional definition of civil disobedience are, in order to like be conscientious or intentional and appropriate perhaps in your civil disobedience, requires these six things. Now, a lot of the people I have represented throughout the years don't necessarily follow all six of these and have some dispute with these. But they are basically, usually it's a protest over something that is unjust. And it is committing a violation of the law. You know it to be illegal. Like my stepdaughter, Keita, and my wife, Ricky, and a couple other people from Holden at Adopt a School of America did what, honey? Why don't you tell them what you did that day?
were not allowed onto the grounds, and so walking over into the grounds of the School of the Americas was illegal. If you were a visitor, it wasn't illegal, but if you were part of this protest, it was. So we just crossed over the line with a lot of other people.
So knowing it was illegal to trespass, they nevertheless did it conscientiously and intentionally. I think the most important of all of these are the next two. Of course, to do it nonviolently, and that's why the violence and the other problems always get all the publicity, but also openly. In other words, when Ricky and Kate and these other people walked over the line, there were the military police, and here were the police, the other people taking names and putting people on buses and all that kind of stuff. Because if you believed you are called for some reason, because of your faith or your politics or your religion or something else, to take this action, and it's important enough so that you're willing to conscientiously violate the law, you shouldn't do it under the cover of night. And that's most often true. That's one of the things that's really disputed by some civil disobedience.
Yeah, I'm going to say a question too. What about people who like quietly don't pay for it? They don't write letters about it or anything. They just regularly,
just
consistently don't follow a law that they feel is unjust or contributes to something that they feel is unjust by our nation. Or state or local.
Now, Nancy, which would you feel was a more effective raising of that issue if you just paid a little less on the bottom line, or if you paid a little less on the bottom line and attached a note saying why?
Well, I think you can do both, but it wouldn't have to be hugely open. I mean, it's different than being in a protest outside of America, wherever.
Yeah.
It's a different kind of.
Right.
And not particularly open. I mean, nobody may ever,
Yeah, and if you do, if you do put an asterisk down by the amount you owe, and put a note on there, there is a greater chance that then the IRS is going to show up at the door, right?
Yeah.
Which is part of the last one,
right.
Acceptance of the punishment. And there would probably be arguments by some in the government that unless you can take that sum of money away from defense appropriations, you maybe are withholding money from other programs that are worthwhile, and therefore, are you respecting the interests of others?
Exactly.
Yeah, it gets very tricky, and a lot of these things get very tricky.
I have two questions. They both have to do with Howard Zinn.
Real loud, so those guys back
there can hear. Both questions have to do with Howard Zinn. He distinguishes between nonviolent responses, saying that. Nonviolent material responses, destruction of property is not necessarily violence, whereas violence towards people is violence. My first question is, how do you respond to that? And the second, or do you want to just respond to the first one?
That's a great question. And let's see, as we go through some of the other people, how they respond to that. That there is a split there. As soon as you start doing some violence, is that become, irresponsible? Say non-Christ-like, or is it only if you get to a point of doing harm to a person, personal harm? Would that be our definition of violence for nonviolent? Big debate.
If you destroy an oil rig without harming any people, is that?
Yeah. Or if you're a protester of animal rights and you blow up a building at night when there's no one around that does testing at it, those sorts of things. So these things can be matters of degree also, how large they are. And I also think that's why this is really important, because you're probably not going to do something really large openly. And that's some of the debate about, they shouldn't be required, the issue is more important. Then it becomes, what is your objective? Father John Deere says, the result is not important, it is only being consistent to your faith. In other words, you don't worry about the result. I think he's in a huge minority, because most of the time people are pragmatic and they're wanting to change a policy. You know, they're wanting in Minneapolis to stop AlliantTech from manufacturing landmines. And so being out there maybe is consistent with their faith, love your neighbor, but if they don't do anything to stop, you know, the production of landmines, they wouldn't go out there, you know, because it is directed toward a result. Anyone else have an idea about that? We'll come back to it and we'll see what some others have said about it.
I do have one idea, and that is that what we're defining here is a term called civil disobedience, which is different than some other other types of behaviors, perhaps. And to me, civil disobedience suggests a certain commitment to an approach that is pretty in line with these notions. Otherwise, it isn't so civil.
You know, if people would ask me that, like at the School of the Americas, the day of the action, I was a lawyer down there for 12 years, I would talk to 5,000 people in one day to, you know, kind of get them ready. And then we'd get that night, we'd get the hardcore that we're really going to go over the line, maybe a couple hundred, and sometimes 2,500. And a lot of those people, you know, wanted so bad to do something to really get immediate impact. So they'd want to break something. And I was always on the side, personally, I would say, you know, I think the message is going to get watered down. And I would like, and just think about if you're really loving your neighbor and you're doing something that's kind of wild, or you're even just laying down and you're requiring the cop to pick you up, you know, he might have three kids at home and a bad back, and that'll put him out of commission for so long. So I was always pushing, although I didn't say what anyone had to do, for kind of the pure form. I didn't like to see property damage start. I thought we really lost a lot of our message if we did that. Yes, exactly. And that's not to say it's right. It's just kind of the way I felt. Here's another definition which doesn't really, you know, use those six particular in a list. Lists always sometimes are problematic. And so this might be a way to escape some of those debates. Deliberate and open. So we have open there. We have civil, as you point out, with the intent to protest a wrong or accomplish some betterment. So it specifically says, you know, we want to accomplish something positive out of this. Okay, so there have been lots of practitioners in nonviolence down through times, but Henry David Thoreau really was, I think he's a deist, I think you'd call him, and he mentions God from time to time, but his action was pretty much a secular act. He was going into town to get his shoes fixed. And he hadn't paid his poll tax because the funds, it was a special poll tax, were going to go to help the Mexican War. And also, he thought, indirectly support a government that was still promoting slavery. And so they grabbed him and threw him in jail. And, you know, Ralph Waldo Emerson came up to him. You all heard the story in ninth grade. And he says, Henry, what are you doing in there? And Henry looked out and says, Ralph, what are you doing out there? And so here are some quotes by him. And then he wrote a pamphlet in 1849, and it wasn't entitled Civil Disobedience, but that's why it got famous, and so some of the subsequent editors changed the name of it to Civil Disobedience. And he was, so he was, you know, affected by the Hindu sacred texts. And he really, you know, looked at every law as that each person should decide, you know, if the law was worth supporting. And so he says, and this, you know, I tie this into what Nancy said, by paying our taxes. Here's what he says, even well-disposed are daily made agents of injustice. If we pay our taxes and we really don't like what a lot of that money's going to, and $1 trillion went to, you know, war and defense and stuff like that last year, a huge amount, then are we agents of injustice? In other words, we're not passive as long as we're silent. as long as we're part of a democracy and, you know, can act out. And so it really, it's kind of a wake-up call on all of us. And I pay my taxes, you know, I don't want to, you know, I used to prosecute guys for tax evasion and defend people for tax crimes. I don't want to go through that. So I compromise, you know, I'm a hypocrite just like everyone else. There he is, handsome devil. So he spent one night in, and then one of his friends came down and bailed him out. So he was, you know, this great philosophical, civilly disobedient guy, but he'd only ever spent one day in jail. So here's another quote from him, and I like it when, you know, he refers to he rarely makes moral decisions, or likely is not to serve without intending as God. Which could be true, just like those of us like me that pay their taxes, and who am I serving by paying taxes? This is really interesting, and you can see Gandhi pick up on this. Gandhi gets to a point where he says, if there is only one person who has really held fast and is completely committed and never wavers and never changes, that one person can make the difference. And this is what the beginning of it. Gandhi studied Thoreau and Jesus, and he says, he's talking about the power of a minority. Here he gets more explicit. And here we're talking about taxes too. So there you have peaceable revolution. Another thing I could put on my list for, you know, the ideas of methods.
I was just going to say an interesting thing about, you know, you say you studied the Bhagavad Gita. The Gita is essentially about why war does have a place. Because
right.
the protagonist, Arjuna, has to fight these other people who essentially are part of his own family, and he feels torn about it. And Krishna comes down and says, there's a time for it.
Yeah.
And so I think it's interesting that he would be an influence on Thoreau, who would argue that
and
maybe there isn't a time for it.
Yeah.
But then Thoreau also supported John Brown in his
right.
Reign on Public Sphere.
Yeah.
So
everyone makes their own decisions.
Yeah.
But Arjuna's internal conflict was a huge piece of that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, how could I be doing this? And, you know, to do
yeah, I mean, it's
whatever
just
it is.
And I love Thoreau. He's
yeah.
great.
Okay, here is Gandhi. Michael in Media Ministry is going to go to law school next year. And I told him the story. I said, when Gandhi, he went down and started practicing in South Africa. When he had his first case and he went in, he was unable to speak at all. He couldn't say a thing. So I said, you know, that's, here's the, Here is something that happened on 9/11 that I want to tell you about. As usual, we're kind of getting behind here, but September 11, 1906, this event occurred in South Africa. I don't know the city, but it was in the Empire Theater in a city. I was going to ask Alan's story, but I forgot to before he left. And they had just passed a law that was, like a lot of those apartheid kinds of things, discriminatory as to the color. Remember, in that society, there was the blacks, there was the color. They brought down a lot of people from India as workers. And I think Gandhi was a pivotal figure. He was a young man then. This is right after he passed the bar. This is maybe a little later by 1906, but he was in the Empire Theater, and they were having a big meeting, and he was ready to leave town. He'd been practicing for a couple of years. He'd got over his muteness, and he was going to go to this meeting, and he was packed, and he was set to go back to India to continue with his career. It didn't happen. And so all these people who spoke many different languages from India were at this meeting in the Empire Theater. And they were deciding what to do. And a man named Shefeth Hajib Habib stood up. He was a very old man. He was Muslim. and he was deeply moved and went so far as to say that we must pass this resolution. This group was passing a resolution, and they had written up some resolutions and things like that, with God as our witness, and must never yield cowardly submission to such degrading legislation. He went on to solemnly declare in the name of God that he would never submit to the law. And at that point, Gandhi, who knew something about oaths, realized, whoa, we're up to something big here. This is the beginning of his formulation of the idea of Satyagraha. And so they had many other discussions, and people were giving flaming speeches, and then all of a sudden Gandhi was different. He started saying, now listen, I'm all in favor of this, but if you're going to make a vow in the name of God, you got to be ready to follow it. And if you follow it, here's what can happen to you. And he went through a parade of horribles, you know, about, you know, losing your property and losing your job and being beaten and being thrown in jail and on and on and on. He said, and if you all understand all of that, then, you know, but let's not vote until we do. And at that point, all the people in the room, there were several hundred people in the room, they rose and they grabbed hands and held it up and decided that they would give that vow in the name of God not to submit to this racist legislation. And he was so moved by what had happened that he said, well, we've got a movement here. What are we going to call it? And so they had a contest to see what they were going to call it. And the first guy, in the contest was Maganlal Gandhi, happened to have the last name, and he suggested the word Satyagraha, meaning firmness in a good cause. I liked the word, but it did not fully represent the whole idea I wished it to connote. I therefore corrected it to Satyagraha. Truth, Satya, means, implies love and firmness. Agraha engenders and therefore serves as a synonym for force. I thus began to call the Indian movement Satyagraha, that is to say, the force which is born of truth and love, or nonviolence. And so, here's one thing he says, and listen to the echo of Thoreau. He said, if many of us fall back under the storm of stress, the struggle will be prolonged, but I can boldly declare, and with certainty, that so long as there is even a handful of men true to their pledge, there can only be one end to the struggle, and that is victory. So, you know, he really picked up on that same thought that Thoreau had. So he had read Civil Disobedience, and he had studied Jesus and the scriptures too. He thought the one teacher, Thoreau was the one teacher besides Jesus who taught nothing he was not prepared to practice in himself. That is, fully take personal responsibility for this conscientious act. So here we have that meeting that started it, and the two facets of it are non-cooperation with evil and cooperation with good. So Gandhi was very much not for non-resistance or passiveness. He was for active non-violence, creative, just like these creative ideas we've been talking about, that, you know, always, he said it was much better to be angry than to be passive, because that was to be impotent, and you could never get anywhere that way. Here's a picture of him. The title of this picture is Force. Isn't that wonderful? Like, soul force. And so this is when he's back in India and leading the nonviolent revolution. And you know, that nonviolent revolution was against the largest, most powerful empire in the world. And they were interested in keeping control, just like other empires are. And they had a tremendous source of labor and goods and resources in India. And this skinny little guy prevailed. Here it is. Therefore, I believe that if one man gains spirituality, the whole world gains. And with him, if one man falls, the whole world falls to that extent. You already saw the interconnectedness. of all people. And then guess who studied Gandhi, as well as Jesus? Martin, you know, did the famous letter from the Birmingham jail, and he said, you know, some of these same things about mutuality and, you know, tied together, all of us, one another. Then, I remember that I was in law school, he shifted to Vietnam. He didn't leave the idea of civil rights, but I remember at a party that Saturday night when he gave that speech, and I thought, oh no, don't water things down, you know, just stay on civil liberties. But here's what he said: I could never raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. Because a million Vietnamese were dying and 550,000 American kids were dying. So the king we hear about on Martin Luther King Day is really watered down. This is the king. Look what he says there about the dominant society, about the roots of our dominant society. You just hear the I had a dream part. The I had a dream was to dismantle, you know, the racism and the sexism and the violence of our society, what he called a radical restructuring of the architecture of American society. That one the media doesn't pick up on anymore, and that's one of the essences of his. These are too little to look at. So these are King's six principles of nonviolence, and I want to keep going. Oh, want to see him?
Yeah, because I can read it.
Oh, great. Okay, we'll just read it nice and fast because we're running out of time.
Gandhi was in Durban, South Africa.
Durban.
Which is the largest Indian population outside of the subcontinent.
Was in the Transvaal, which is, and Durban, I think, was the capital. Thank you very much. I thought it was Durban, and I didn't want to say it for fear that someone would know it wasn't. This is really, the next person we're going to look at is Barbara Deming, and you can see here her two hands philosophy. That is, on the one hand, you cooperate with good, but on the other hand, you resist evil. So you do not resist evil passively. You call it what it is and act assertively. That is, you go after the evil act, not the person who you see. Because this whole thing, when we started yesterday, remember I wrote on the board, Pax Romana is about domination. Pax Christi is about relationship. So this is to be able to go through the resistance without breaking relationship. That's what's so amazing about actually what happened when the whole thing turned on civil rights, when Martin got blasted with, and a lot of people with him, with these water hoses. And there was a lot of damage caused, and there was a lot of beating going on and stuff like that. And a few days later, Lyndon Johnson came on TV to the nation. I mean, because this is a good thing about media. Media played that almost live, you know, to people that had television sets, which was most everyone. And Lyndon Johnson was deeply moved. And he gave a speech about civil rights. This is a Texas senator. You know, who I'm sure had a lot of people vote for him that thought Martin was not too good. And he got done with the whole speech, and he promised some action on civil rights, and the Civil Rights Act did get enacted the next year. And he closed on TV. It was all done. He looked at the monitor, and he was totally emotional, and he said, "We shall overcome." President of the United States. So, this worked. Barbara Deming. I bet nobody, who's ever heard of Barbara Deming? Remarkable woman. There's a kid's picture of her. She was hard as steel. She really looked at these issues from a secular standpoint and from an idea of accomplishing the goals, of changing policies. And so she came at it from a pragmatic and and at the same time a militant viewpoint. She says she made the distinction between power and conscience. So she says to resort to power, one need not be violent, and to speak to conscience, one need not be meek. And so those are the two different hands. You know, you can be seeking power and be powerful, but at the same time, you can do it out of conscience. She clearly drew this line that, what's your name? Stephen was talking about. Like, can we do physical, can we do property damage? She felt very clearly we should be able to do property damage. I'll talk more about that tomorrow when I talk about Roy Bourgeois at the School of the Americas, because there was some property damage there. Almost all symbolic. There was never any, you know, personal damage. But she said it's important because the work was more important as long as physical harm wasn't done. The other thing is, she was a strategist. How much attention can you really capture? And the more attention you can capture, the faster you can get to your result. If you don't undermine your constituency in the first place. So she did property damage to the USS Ranger. First of all, she protested for civil rights and became a friend of Martin. Then she protested against the Vietnam War, became friends of the Berrigans and most people. And then late in life, she came out of the closet and she protested for gay rights. So she really had the gamut. She talked about, she theorized this third party effect at Selma. She said, maybe some of the people, if you do something outrageous enough, maybe some property damage, will be turned off. But if you jump over those people and get such a wider audience beyond that, it's worth it. That is, because you create a groundswell of support and the movement succeeds at an earlier time. And here she is in a gay rights movement. She always had this amazing, laconic look on her face. And she wrote a wonderful piece about all these things. She thought about it very carefully, and I've got it in a crumpled up old book that I had to get on Amazon for $3, you know. I mean, there's no way you can find it in being published anymore. So, yeah, then I start doing some stuff for my class. What do people think about civil disobedience and the requirements? And an interesting thing, when you think about civil disobedience, don't think about what King did or what Gandhi did, because you can see the result was great. Everyone always feels like civil disobedience done in the past was great. Almost everyone thinks about civil disobedience that you're going to do tomorrow. You know, in Chelan, if you're going to spill some blood on the U.S. Post Office, wait a second. That's not so good. You know, there must be a better way to go about that. And, you know, perhaps there can be, but I just found this amazing anomaly is that past civil disobedience is always aggrandized, and future disobedience, civil disobedience. Several times I remember trying a case for a lawyer that refused to pay his war taxes for Vietnam. And the jury really liked the guy and they convicted him. And afterwards, these jurors all came over to me and says, well, we couldn't vote for your guy because he was really guilty, but he should have done it a different way. And so it's always easy to say, you know, you should have done it a different way, or don't you really do it, or there's risks, or that kind of thing. So overall, I mean, are there any of the people who have done civil disobedience or have any ideas? But what were you
going to
say?
I was going to say that it takes as much training and as much money behind it as the military training, time and money and commitment. People think, very often think pacifism may be easier, or just lying down and doing nothing, but it is action. Civil disobedience, pacifism is action, and that action takes time and training. You can't do it without training. And do we have enough, you know, building up enough force, sufficient citizens force?
I represent a group of...
Is it a school? Is it a
Is there like...
Are there schools?
Yeah.
You know, we have our war academies, but where are the peace academies? And so we are trying in Washington, D.C. to...
The Department of Peace.
Yes.
Peter, is there anything to be learned from countries that don't have militaries? Or have had a history of neutrality as an official policy, who haven't been, in a sense, war states?
I think so. Costa Rica, in particular, you look at almost every country down there that have had their military junta's and their disappearances, and then a democratically elected person, and then a coup, and then a military junta, and just continuing violence back and forth in Costa Rica. Business all of it.
Yeah.
And they haven't had a military. Now, each circumstance is unique, you know, and so the lessons, what she's saying is that it's what Gene Sharp says. He's written the Bibles on nonviolence, big three-volume set, and he says, isn't it time we get serious about studying it, training it, you know, honoring it, like the Nonviolent Peace Force pays these guys $800 a month. You don't have to just be a pure volunteer to go risk your life. And so that approach it in a professional way. I think that's very important.
I'm following up on your, I mean, is it making sure the Peace Corps gets more dollars? Because isn't that a way to serve the country in another way as well?
Represented six nuns. I'll give you a specific case and see what you thought about this. Six nuns down at the School of the Americas, average age about 78. And they went in with crowbars, and on the front, right at the gate where Ricky walked over the line, there's a great big rock, and it says Fort Benning, U.S. Army. And then down below it, in pretty big letters, it says School of the Americas, which is where your tax dollars paid to train people that went back to South America and, you know, murdered religious and human rights workers and their own people and union workers and all that. So they went in there and they pried off these letters with the crowbars, and they bent the letters a little and they fell on the ground, and then they had a sign and it said School of the Assassins, and they tied the sign up there in place of School of the Americas to make their point. So, you know, they were arrested and went to court in LA, and we had a trial. What do you think of that? There was property damage. The U.S. Army came in and they had experts at the trial, and they said this cost us $1,300 to replace the sign and, you know, get new letters and, you know, hire the contractors and have the mortar and all that kind of stuff. So what about that? I mean, did they screw up their message? Do you agree with what they did? Did they go too far? Did they not go far enough? What do people think? There's
just
a...
right.
Pardon me?
They did it just right.
You like
yeah.
it?
Like
you like it.
It. Yeah.
What if they hadn't been nuns and they'd just been six from in here?
78-year-olds, go for it.
Yeah. That's what one of them told me. They said, I didn't know if I was strong enough to get this letter off, Mr. Thompson. And I went to the first letter, and I had an aha moment, because it just popped right out. I said, glory to God. So is God happy that the U.S. Army had to pay extra money? I don't know. What do you think, Peter? How would God feel about the physical violence?
I don't know how God would feel. I mean, that's a million-dollar question. Jesus, yeah, we would feel.
Yeah. Well, we're not too bothered about it so far.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, both of you.
Just as one small example in our little town I come from, Aberdeen, Washington. This man has had a business for years. He works on Volvos, which... you know, got to go all the way to Seattle to, you know, do that. He's never paid federal taxes. He's never paid city taxes. He's never paid any taxes over the years. The that he's had this business. His doors have been kicked in, his windows have been broken out for different reasons, but he maintains and keeps going, and he's in his 80s now, but every time he ended up in jail, his wife would take his law books to him, and how much education he had, I don't know. He was out within 2 or 3 days, and he just continued the fight. They don't own their own home. It's just a continual thing
he's
doing.
Was it resistance to war?
It was really with him as a resistance to taxes you were talking about.
If it was all taxes for all purposes, to me that would kind of be the Tea Party. And I think we need taxes to run this country. You know, the founders weren't against taxes. They were very reticent to give all the power up for any kind of taxation. What they didn't like was taxation without representation. So they realized taxes were necessary.
But he knew how to decipher and read those laws, and he was never really in jail very long.
I think one of the beauties that I've observed of civil disobedience is sometimes forcing the authorities to have to answer the question of what's going on. And we're from Los Angeles, and we have observed our friends at the Los Angeles Catholic Workers over the past 30 years. And when the Catholic Church decided to build this huge cathedral in downtown Los Angeles, it cost millions and millions of dollars, the small Catholic workers went and chained themselves to the bulldozers. And of course, it didn't stop the building of the cathedral, but it forced the church, the archbishop, to have to address the issue of the homeless if they were being displaced. And it got a lot of media attention. So rather than these things just happening, and they had to make some concessions about using some property for.
Yeah, oftentimes it can promote dialogue right there in the trenches. Because, the person who comes to arrest you, you can look at them, respect them, and, have true dialogue. Because the person's saying, what the heck are you doing here? And you have an opportunity, at least with one person, or maybe when you go to court, with 12 other people, to tell them.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the Los Angeles Times was pretty much right across the street, so they had an opportunity to tell, all of
thousands, yeah. Great.
Have there been any studies done about the impact of property damage on a movement? Because that's where I struggle is the damage of the property. And I don't like the scene of it at all, the government or town. I can't imagine going down there and buying the letter drop with something else up there.
Yeah.
I'd love to protest and try in different ways what the casino does to a community.
Yeah.
But has anybody done a comprehensive study of the property damage issue specifically in respect?
Not in a broader sense, but the anti-animal lobby has really hurt themselves with the property damage because some of it's been extreme because both Congress and a lot of state legislatures have passed eco-terrorism laws. And that eco-terrorism is way overstating what it is, but they've been successful in getting them through. So it's bad PR with lawmakers, at least extensive property damage. And these RNC people back in St. Paul at the Republican National Convention, the ones who did some damage, I think that hurt a lot of what people were trying to do in the anti-war protests because they broke windows and things.
You were sort of talking about dialoguing with the enemy or the other side. And this is just a humorous thing, but when Kata had crossed the line one other year with my daughter, and she was 18, and she and her friend, were taken to the holding pen where the officers were guarding them, and she came, she was kind of scared and came back and she said, those guys that were hurting us?
That's breaking down barriers.
I just
we talk about this, the way in which certain kinds of acts of protest are so violent as to make us feel unsafe, you know, and once we feel unsafe, then once an act is committed that is essentially threatening, and you know, then we have all sorts of other reactions, I think, that get in the way of any kind of measure of symbolism that we might ascertain from the act that those nuns committed was perfect. Seven nuns and crowbars and letters. We're not threatened inherently by that kind of act, but we're brought to consciousness. But some of these other behaviors just scare us in and of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And
if that's the emotion, rather than being you know, concerned about the injustice, obviously a lot of the message gets diluted.
Yeah, I agree with you completely about the fear aspect, but I also think conjoined with that is the idea that our relationship with individual, or how we feel about property. I mean, we still believe fervently that property is the individual.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we need to begin to move away from that. I mean, it goes back 3-4 centuries to John Locke saying, you know, okay, this is, you have made this, it is yours. And what we fail to see is that, well, yes, you have made this, but you also took from the earth to make that. And you've also gotten help from other people to make that. And you've also gotten help from your family. You know, and so whatever you have is not necessarily just yours. It is the product of everything. You know, and providential. So I think that's another aspect that I totally agree with you.
And so dismantling something and blowing it up can have two different impacts on us. Both which could be related to what you're talking about, but also one of them could cause a great deal of discomfort, the other not so much.
See what I mean about holding? I mean, I learn a lot from here every time. Okay, we'll do a little more civil disobedience tomorrow.